Now, I wonder where you stand on the question of nuclear power. Not military nuclear power necessarily, but nuclear electricity generation. You probably know that towards the end of the campaign, the federal election campaign, many people within the Liberal Party were saying we need to have a very good look at nuclear power. Anthony Albanese has not said a lot, but essentially he said, no, it's far too expensive. We need to rely on renewables. But is nuclear power far too expensive? If you look at all of the costs involved, right through to the end of its life and even decommissioning of a nuclear power plant, that's exactly what my next guest has been looking at. Rob Parker is the founder of Nuclear for Climate Australia, and he's written a really interesting essay called Energy Sustainability and Human Dignity. Now, there's a lot to get into here, but Rob explains it reasonably well. A lot of it is around energy density and the history of how humans have evolved alongside the amount of energy we can extract out of the resources of the world. And he's also quoting from some brand new research from the United Nations and the European Union Joint Research Council about the whole life cycle of all sorts of electricity generating options. So, with an open mind, I reckon you should give Rob Parker a bit of an ear over the next 15 minutes or so. First of all, I asked him to explain the concept of energy density.
Energy density for just us consumers. Let's think about one of the simplest forms of where this plays out for us. I, like many of your other listeners, probably burn wood in our fires, in our homes. And if we have to do that, we have to go out there and we have to chop the wood, saw the wood, and do a lot of work to get it actually into the home. And then we have to take the ash out and we have to do all of these simple things. And that's a lot of work to get heat into the home. And I was reminded,
if you were going from, you're talking about doing it from scratch, that you go out, get the wood, chop the wood, split the wood, bring it inside, stack it, then bring it inside, then burn it.
Dry it out.
Yeah, and wait. And so all of that is a lot of effort to get a certain amount of energy.
A lot of effort and a lot of work on our part.
Yes.
And that goes back, as I say in that article, to the period before industrialism, when we were getting about 10 units of energy out for every unit of energy in. And so that human capital that's been consumed by gathering up energy isn't available for any inventiveness or doing anything else. And in some parts of the world, even now, we know that in India, they gather up dung for burning fires. And all of that is extremely low-grade energy.
Right.
And so when the British had managed to either turn all their forests into ships or burn it, eventually they decided they had to go to coal. And that energy density from coal created the Industrial Revolution. So it enabled people to move out of low energy density rural areas into high energy density communities where they went into manufacturing.
Right.
Now, that wasn't always for them, unfortunately, a pleasant transition.
Okay, this is true. So burning wood, it's a 1 to 10 amount of effort, 10 units of energy.
Yes.
Burning coal is about 1 to 30, correct?
1 to 30, 1 to 70 perhaps, but of that order.
Okay. And then we move to nuclear power, as we did in the 50s and 60s. What are the numbers there?
Well, the beauty of nuclear power is that even with our less efficient nuclear processes, we're up around about 100 units out for every unit of effort put in. That's because of the massive energy density of splitting the atom. And when we split a uranium atom, we get 20 million times more energy than, for example, burning one atom of carbon with oxygen to give us heat. And so it's that massive energy density, which means that when we craft nuclear power stations, we don't need to use very many materials. And so they have a very, very small environmental footprint.
Mm. But the number we're trying to get to is how much energy versus how much unit of effort. And it's 100 or more for nuclear power,
yes.
Correct?
And in the future, with future nuclear processes, it'll double or triple because there are future nuclear processes that are even more efficient than the ones we're currently using. And so that's why I think in the future, mankind will inevitably go down that route of going towards energy density. That's what the history has told us, because then it releases mankind's resources to do more creative things. The energy becomes our tool, not our master. Mm. So we don't have to structure our lives around gaining energy. We have it there available at economic prices to be able to craft industries, to be able to build things.
Okay.
That's the idea.
So that's the first part of your argument, is the energy density of this fuel. Now,
yes.
In the past when I've spoken to you, I will occasionally have someone from the anti-nuclear camp, or someone will text or call to talk about the environmental consequences of nuclear power plants. Now, this is ignoring any accidents, but they say what you're ignoring, Nick and Rob, is the whole of life of carbon used in making a nuclear power plant, from the pouring of the slab to the building of the containment dome, et cetera, et cetera. But you've pointed out some research from the UN and the EU on the actual environmental consequences, environmental impacts of various forms of generation. Can you take me through those?
Yes. The three references in the document that I put together, and two of them can certainly never be claimed to be shrills for the nuclear industry. The first was the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe, and the second was the European Union's Joint Research Centre Council. And the United Nations document in particular has got some 11 or 12 different parameters where they look at the environmental consequences of using all energy systems, including nuclear. And when you read through all of those, and if we go first to the most relevant one, I guess, is carbon emissions. And under their documents, they're reconciling, they find that nuclear has an emissions intensity, which includes the construction, the decommissioning, and the fuel storage, and the waste disposal, all of those processes, including mining, of the order of 6 grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour. And they went into wind and solar, and wind is pretty good. Wind is there probably at around about the 20 or 30 region, and solar is a bit higher, up around the 30 or 40. And so they look at these energy intensities of each of the systems. And what they found is that nuclear has the lowest emissions intensity of any energy source, with the exception of small-scale hydro, which really is not an option for us in Australia. And so that's the first benefit. But as the listeners are probably aware, there is considerable concern over the cancer-producing potential of nuclear energy. And so amongst all of these parameters, they looked at the non-cancer forming and the cancer forming toxicity of nuclear. And they found that nuclear has about the second lowest cancer forming potential, beaten only to lowest place by, again, small hydro. And so it lines up very well with wind and solar on a cancer potential. In fact, it's got the lowest priority potential. So then they went into other parameters, for example, the pollution of our waterways when we build these systems. And nuclear performs very well on every parameter. So when they total all of those up, nuclear does the business. It's amongst the lowest. It's only a few dot points below wind and solar, and it's just beaten out to lowest places again by very low hydro.
You also mention, because the title of your essay is Energy Sustainability and Human Dignity, the human cost. What's your issue with solar power, particularly when it comes from China?
Well, Sheffield Hallam University in the United Kingdom produced a document about a year ago which looked at what are effectively forced labour camps within Zhejiang province in China by the Uyghur people. And these people are effectively forced into these camps to produce polysilicon. And the paper found that about 45% of the polysilicon produced globally was produced in these forced labour camps. And that affected about 90 of the Chinese industries. So this stuff finds its way into about 90 of the different industries. So as I say in the article, if you've got solar panels made in China, chances are it's been on the backs of forced labour. And this forced labour is what is underpinning the suggestions that solar will always have this downward trajectory. Actually been built on the backs of people in forced labour camps. And of course, we've seen around the globe that China has managed through its competitiveness using these sorts of mechanisms to wipe out the solar manufacturing in Australia, the United States, and throughout Europe. And so the world has ended up stuck in this conundrum of using this source, which puts a downward price on solar for just about every other nation, but it's at a terrible human toll.
Rob Parker's with us for Nuclear for Climate Australia, discussing his latest essay. Rob, finally, why is the nuclear debate significant for the war in Ukraine as well?
Well, we had Germany, who's long been the poster child for renewables in Europe. By 2025, it's calculated that the Germans will have spent 520 billion euros or 790 billion Australian dollar equivalent on an Energiewende transition to renewables. With the lulls in wind power, which we saw in the last European springtime, that's not proving to be correct. And in the lead up to the Ukrainian war, we saw a massive increase in the demand from gas from Putin. And the German economy is locked into that as they transition away from nuclear to what has effectively now been a gas and coal recovery, because they are not really replacing, and they're not building out enough renewables to replace this. And so their emissions, even on a first-up calculation, are about 500 grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour. But if you put in those fugitive emissions of Putin's methane, it gets you way up around 700-800. So there's been no real benefit for this Energiewende transition, unlike across the border, for example, in nuclear-powered France, where they have a much lower emissions intensity, down around 30 grams, 40 grams. Carbon dioxide. But the unfortunate part about this, really, Nick, is that while Britain and the United States have sent heavy armaments to help the Ukrainian people defend themselves, Germany has been a bit of a laggard in this area, and they've not sent heavy armaments. They've talked the talk, but they have not actually walked the walk. And so there's been a real problem in Germany really supporting the defence of the Ukrainian people, and that is taking a toll. And behind China, Germany is the single largest payer of money to Putin for this gas and oil that they're importing. Mm. So they've really got to revert, and it would be great if the Germans would turn their nuclear power plants back on, and we're seeing this morning, polls taken throughout Germany where the German people are now starting to favour nuclear once again. Mm. And it'd be great if they could sort out both their emissions and also reduce the payments they're paying to Putin.
Now, finally, and I'm hoping you can explain this simply, but you talk about the new technology in reactors that, regardless of the efficiency, most people would just be scared of the chances of a nuclear accident. Now, we can put aside the many deaths that are caused by coal particulates, et cetera, just for the moment. But why are new reactors like molten salt reactors so much safer compared to the kind of thing we saw at Chernobyl or Three Mile Island?
Well, the molten salt reactors, okay, and that's a really good question. And for the view, for the listeners who've seen that Chernobyl series, they will have seen something happen in that, whereby when the operators got that reactor out of control, the thing blew up. And that was caused by a particularly inherent design flaw in that reactor.
Which they knew about but didn't fix. Yeah,
that's correct. And it's called a positive void coefficient to get into a technical term, but we won't go too far down that. The guts of it means that for the reactors that we have got in the West, and we'll talk here about our normal, simple, light water reactors, firstly. If they heat up, the reaction reduces. It does not go the other way, unlike the Russian situation. So those reactors reduce in their output. They do not increase if they heat up. So that's the most important difference, that we could not get the replication of what happened in the Russian reactors. Now, you mentioned the molten salt. Likewise, in the molten salt reactor, one of the benefits of those is that, okay, light water reactors, you heat the water up, like in a pressure cooker, it gets more pressure, and so that's got to be designed for in the process. In the molten salt reactor, it's operating at atmospheric pressure, so you don't need big pressurized systems. But as well as that, if it heats up, the fuel expands. And when the fuel expands, the reaction goes backwards and the thing becomes self-stabilizing. So that's the big benefit for those. And also, you don't need anywhere near as heavy an amount of hardware in that type of reactor as you need in our current fleet, which means you don't need to put as many materials in to build it, which means your energy returned on energy investment goes up. And that's why I mentioned in the article, with that style reactor, we could end up at 200 or 300 times the amount of energy coming out per unit invested.
That's Rob Parker, an engineer and founder of Nuclear for Climate Australia. His latest article is called Energy Sustainability and Human Dignity.